Not unlike lingering over a glass of good wine, today we'll be speaking only with viticulturalist Mimi Castile from Hopewell Vineyards. There are words for grape growers and winemakers. Add to those regenerative farmer and consultant, and that's Mimi. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio, October 2023. Grab a shovel and or your earbuds and a glass of wine, and let's dig in. Mimi, I heard you speaking at a recorded event titled Seeking an Optimum and Never a Maximum, and that feels like the regenerative direction, moving out of the industrial-driven, let's run over everything and get there first mentality.
Yes, I think regenerative and regeneration is going to have to fortify its integrity against the thing that's pulled agriculture ever since agriculture was begun, which is this immediate feedback loop that we get very inspired by, where you can just take and take and nature provides more and more. And that's a very short feedback loop. It has a definite end. It's not even really a loop, it's a line. And I think if regenerative is going to be a term that inspires and holds integrity and space and strength over time, abundance is what nature promises, not a maximum, not yield of one thing over all else. And it's only through embracing the diversity of, you know, what we've been given that we will be able to achieve abundance in perpetuity.
Right. Yes. Variety is the spice of life, has many lines that can be drawn to it, certainly. And you grew up on your parents' Bethel Heights vineyard in Oregon and are now part owner and have also moved onto a parcel of land fairly close by that you've named Hopewell. Tell us about the Hopewell property, the landscape, acreage, rainfall, etc.
So it's very small, intentionally very small. My previous site was 80 acres, and this has been just such a journey. I know you have your own journey, and I think we all come to this work having been inspired at many points along the way and endured many existential crises along the way. And for me, one of the things that I realized at my previous site, and even at my parents' estate, is that I'm growing increasingly uncomfortable with the idea of land ownership. And so when I left my previous site, which was 80 acres, I decided to lease. I have a lifetime lease, but I decided to lease instead of own. And it's basically 3 acres, and it's under vine, and there's oak trees and a huge hedgerow that I've installed. And we're trying to, again, rebuild the diversity of that little spot that we're on, but also work with the people that connect to us to have that be connected habitat and connected ecosystemic integrity. That was an intentional move for me, just to work smaller and with more intention and put more love into what I could see and what I could touch. And it's not to say I don't think that people can do these things on larger properties and work this way on larger properties. But for me, where I feel comfortable and sane is in this sort of deep understanding and embracing the fact that I'm owned by the land.
Right.
And I don't own anything. I want to do my part, and I want to be a benign force in this world. That's been just kind of where I've arrived at this point in the journey, and who knows where it's going next. But that's been a stepwise getting here. Started from a very young age on my parents' estate. The part that I loved the most were the edges where everything was wild, and coming back to that work after a career in public lands and forest ecosystems, questioning everything that I thought I understood about agriculture, and then moving that first at that estate to my own estate, and then sort of giving up the idea of estate or ownership altogether. It's been a long path.
Yes, and a very inner focused and centered path as well by the sound of it. So you have another 3 acres now beside the Hopewell, 80 acres. Am I understanding that correctly? Or
no, we left the previous site. So that is now under another steward. We sold that land. It was really after the 2020 fires when, you know, at that estate, that was the original Hopewell. So Hopewell, the philosophy, the name came with me, and the site obviously is now under different stewardship. But in 2020, the fires meant that we basically made no red wine, and all of my grape clients, I was selling about 75% of the fruit that I grew there to other wineries, and we lost all those contracts. And at that time, there was no smoke insurance rider for our, basically our crop insurance.
Right.
I mean, it was a devastating year economically, but we would have been able to, we would have been able to make it. It wasn't a death blow financially,
right.
But because it was also the pandemic, and because of sort of the way the pandemic, I think, made me really look at what I spend my time on and who it serves and what is the purpose. Part of the reason that we started there was to rehabilitate a piece of degraded land. It had been a Christmas tree farm, and I just had this dream of basically healing lands through better work, but maintaining a working lands philosophy. And we were doing that work, but selling the fruit was difficult because you're working within this expectations of all the other people that you're selling to. And it was very meaningful to me in that I thought that this would help change other people's practices as they saw fruit quality being not just high, but as high, the highest region of fruit quality, but then also this very different looking paradigm for a vineyard where it's not just bare ground and pretty green rows of just vines, you know, where
right.
fence post vineyard. You know, I think things did change. I didn't change as fast as I wanted to. People thought I were crazy, but they were inspired by the fruit and inspired by the work. And in 2020, when all of those people basically, they couldn't make wine either, but they basically broke contracts. I wasn't going to litigate or anything like that. It was one of those moments where you say, okay, my family doesn't get enough of my time. I put everything, all of my love and devotion is so connected to where we are. And we've put this on the path of recovery. And we've seen this through this journey of proving out a proof of a concept. But I don't have to do this for other people in this way anymore. Wine for me is, I'm very clear with myself about this now. We're not saving lives with wine. Wine is inspiring. It's a cultural product. It's all the beautiful things that I think people genuinely fall in love with. They get very inspired by. And for me, it's a thing that anchors my creativity to the natural world. And I do love it, but I am very aware that as an occupier of land, especially very precious and fragile habitats, I don't need it to be any bigger than just a very small thing for me. And outside of that, I want to work with as many people who want to get on the path and start connecting their lands with the ecosystem and the landscape that could truly start to rebuild itself if we were doing that work collaboratively. So instead of working in a vacuum on 80 acres and trying to change a few people's minds by selling them fruit, I know this is very long-winded, I decided very intentionally to make that very small. So Hopewell now is just those 3 acres. I'm still part owner of Bethel Heights as well. And I mostly am just working with a lot of other growers, both in viticulture and outside of viticulture, to look at ways to rebuild ecosystems and make whatever they're making ever better as a result of those practices.
Yes, and that feels like an even deeper dive into regenerative. I know organic has been around for 50 years or so, and now there's a regenerative movement. And sometimes I wonder, well, in 50 years, what will this look like? What will regenerative have lost and or gained, and where do we need to go from here? And boy, I think you're on the leading edge of it right now, because if you have 3 acres, then that allows someone else to have 3 more acres and exactly. have that experience, which is just explosive in life, I know. So did you say that this 3 acres had a vineyard on it already?
Yeah. One of the sort of deepest feelings that I came to realize and embrace in moving from the previous site was that I don't want more vines to go in the ground. I'd never want habitat to be lost. Not even super comfortable. I wasn't super comfortable with the idea of converting another piece that was already farmland to viticulture, because I think there is enough land under vine right now to make all the extraordinary wine and make it better. And frankly, there could probably be less land under vine and we could make better wines if we focused more on less. And so I really wanted to find something that was already planted. Grafting is an extremely awesome tool to work with the varieties that you want to work with, even if they're not currently what's there. If you have the existing rootstock, you can graft a standover, which is what I did. So those 3 acres were already planted. I grafted the entire thing to budwood from my previous estate. So just taking that life and bringing it to the new site, that's really part of what I'm committed to. I don't like the way that we sort lands and assign qualitative metrics to them, because it's so at odds with what I believe is true, which is that every little millimeter of space on this earth is precious in some way, and it can express itself uniquely in some way. And so it was really just more about finding the right size of place and a location that wasn't terribly impossible to get to from right. where we live. So it worked out really, really beautifully.
Nice. Well, excuse my naivety in all of this process, but when you are grafting, is that a way to extend the life of a vineyard, or is it just a way to bring the type of grapes that you want onto a property to change that? Does it have anything to do with extending the life of the vineyard?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's actually a really great question, and I don't even think many viticulturists look at it this way. I mean, are you familiar with, I'm sure you are, you're familiar with coppicing, which is a technique done a lot in Europe. It's not so much in the United States. With certain perennial crops, not even perennial crops, certain perennial woody plants,
yes.
If you prune them very hard, they regenerate themselves for so much longer. And one of the things that's really becoming a significant issue in the United States and in Europe and places all around the world for vineyards is wood disease. So grafting and trunk renewal both are opportunities to extend the life of the roots that we're working with and get not just new varieties into the vineyard, but really regenerate the health of a trunk that has significant age. And one of the things that I think is really significant about that is that for wine quality, the age of the roots and the age of the plant itself as a system is a major influence on wine quality, because the older and the deeper the roots are and the larger the root system, the more it is in connection with and in conversation with that ecosystem that we're trying to rebuild. Mm. And so replanting and starting from babies, I mean, there's something exciting about that. But really, to me, the idea of renewing an old trunk and just bringing new life from that old system is so compelling. And it really does set you forward in terms of what you can get qualitatively.
Bravo, yes. And I wanted to ask you, when you came onto this property, you're talking about the grafting that you're doing, what did you see and what did you do as far as helping and working with the soil to be at its best? What are some specifics there?
Well, for me, it's always contextual. So you walk into any new system and you have to be cognizant of the way you're going to have to work in that system. And this one was already planted in the spacing that it was. And there were some vines that had been girdled by voles, and most people would replace those with new vines. In a lot of those places, we had little apple seedlings growing up and we're letting those grow. And so that's one of the ways that we're working with the soil is to have different perennial root systems growing, not just on the edges in that hedgerow that we've also installed, which is part of the soil health program, but also in the vineyard system itself, we're allowing for some other perennials to be plumbing different depths of that water table and breaking up different compaction layers. And one of the benefits of working on 3 acres is that the tractor burden is so much less. So on 80 acres, you really can't do some of the work without implements. And on 3, I can do a lot of the work myself on foot. And so it's a much lighter path. So this time I'm working with no-till drilling in some of the natives that they want to come back. They're in the seed bed already, but we're trying to release some of those and trying to seed in some of, especially the pollinator natives that we've lost over time just to removal of habitat and sort of loss of connectivity. So we're working on really identifying which ones of the natives seem like they're suitable, durable enough to be in a working land situation, but offer so many of the benefits of having drought tolerance and deep root systems, and a lot of them are flowering and are pollinator friendly. So trying to, again, starting from where we are, meeting the place where it is, increase the diversity in the vine rows themselves and also around the edges, really putting in some intentional structural habitat so that not just insects, beneficial insects and things like that have refugia, but also so that birds have places to land and nest, and they can help us with the insect pressure, and wildlife can be a part and have places to go, because we're not disturbing the soil, but a lot of the soil around us is repeatedly disturbed. And so just trying to offer some islands of refugia, both the wildlife and the invertebrates that need those things.
Yes, absolutely. It sounds amazing. And you mentioned the apple seeds that are coming up. How close would you let an apple seedling come up into a potential apple tree to a vine?
Well, you know, it'll be an interesting experiment. And I feel very comfortable at this point. People have thought I'm crazy for as long as I've been making wine. So I'm very comfortable with doing things that seem very risky, and maybe they won't work out, but why not try? And we're in very close proximity to an orchard, and so these volunteers are coming up all over the place. The vineyard's established. I'm comfortable seeing what amount of competition we get underground, but then in terms of how it grows, we can always prune the lower limbs, and if it starts to interfere with the trellis, then, you know, I can either remove the wires between those posts that it's growing between, or we can prune it in a particular way to see how big of a tree we can let it be. But I'm just curious to see what the effect will be. And more, you believe these things to be true, right? And everywhere in the regenerative space, we hear that diversity is important. But until you prove it to yourself, and until you've had the experience of following your work through time, as diversity increases at every level, and I really do believe that as stewards of the land where habitat has been lost, part of our job is to change these systems to accommodate the structural diversity that we need for true ecosystem health. You know, maybe we'll have to take out 2 or 3 more grapevines. And hey, I'm okay with that. I really am. I think that you do get more with less when you allow for the system the sort of architectural form that it deserves to be, because we limit what's possible below ground when we're just working with even a diversity of annual and perennial forbs. If we start increasing shrub layers and tree layers as well, the potential energy flow into that system is exponentially increased.
Absolutely.
And for me,
yes,
I'll make less wine every single day if it's better and more energetic and more reflective of where it's from.
Right. And reflective of where it's from is so important and key, certainly, to what you're doing. And you spoke a little bit about no-till, and you've spoken a lot about it in articles and podcasts. Is it unique in viticulture to do no-till, or what is that looking like across the board?
Well, it didn't used to be, and certainly not in America, where on the West Coast, where I grew up, you know, we never cultivated until the viticulture sort of changed to look more like the old world. So when the first French people came to Oregon, and I'm not throwing stones at the French, but that aesthetic of very much tighter spacing, lots of cultivation, that really came with a sort of second generation of wine growing, in at least in Oregon, and certainly that's also true in California now. And yet now, I think, because wine has been a bit on the progressive edge of agriculture and has certainly represented the sort of highest achievement and value add for agriculture, there's this progressive tendency or a leaning towards defining what you do by your impact on the land, because we're so tied to this word terroir. We use it so much that I think that, at least I would hope, we consider ourselves more accountable to defending or talking about why we do certain things on the land. And so now that the regenerative movement really is taking hold and people have heard these conversations about soil health and what it means to use some of these implements repeatedly over time, that more and more people are transitioning to no-till. And I think it's where it's really the trickiest part of this viticultural system is weaning people off of cultivation, especially in areas that were semi-arid to begin with and are trending towards greater aridity, because there's this there's this period of time where if you go from cultivating, where you're just chewing through whatever organic matter you were able to grow, if you had a cover crop or any vegetation growing, then you till that up and it gets consumed very quickly by the organisms that are there, and that food is readily available to your plants. That's a very short feedback loop, but it's a very positive, you see the positive impacts on your grape plants. But that hamstrings the entire system from ever being able to accumulate organic matter, and it certainly degrades soil integrity over time. And so it's a law of very strict and very quick diminishing returns. And then you really just are hooked up to that. It's like an addiction. And so if you want to build back up to a point where you are no longer dependent on cultivation for your plants to be green and healthy, but what you've grown accustomed to looking at, they need to adjust to that new system. And it can be pretty scary for people because it is initially competitive. So I think it's one of the places where we can be the most helpful to each other is getting each other through those transition periods, because there are things that you can do to sort of help the vines along the way, whether that's composting, using different plants in your cover crop sort of along the way, a successional sort of cover cropping system, if you will, so that you're very nutritious early on, or maybe you're doing less cultivation for a while and really trying to build organic matter to a point where it can be sustained and even grow and share with your plants as well. So it's one of those things that I think we need to talk about it more, because it's not binary. You can't just say that a transition plan in this place works in every place, because it's not true. And that makes people very frustrated, and it makes them think it's not possible. And I really do firmly believe that if viticulture is suitable for any particular place, it can be done without cultivation, but it just takes time.
Now, in saying that, Mimi, do you use amendments like sea minerals or anything like that, or compost tea sprays? Or
yes. So I have done a lot of different things, depending on where I was working and what the state of affairs was getting there. So I do like to know certain things going into whether I'm working with a client or even, you know, having moved to my new estate. At the previous site, we had no organic matter when we started. It was not measurable in most places. And then over time, we really grew that very aggressively for a number of years before we had enough to really establish vines and have that be a no-till system. Where I am now, we went in and we already had a pretty decent amount of organic matter for something that had been previously farmed. And so we were able to transition to some of those natives more quickly. So we'll do, especially if I'm working with clients who are very trepidatious about transitioning, we'll do blocks where you can prove it to yourself first. And I think that's really important to take a scientific approach and be able to have checks on your practices so that you can convince yourself that these things are working and not just, oh, it's just this season, we got a little bit more rain or XYZ. I mean, we really do need that sort of side by side, I think, to convince ourselves so that we have a durable belief system that, you know, that holds up over time. And we'll use foliar minerals. I do a lot of compost tea, and I'm a big believer, especially in soil applications of compost tea for vineyard systems where that aggregate structure has been damaged by cultivation and you really need to increase that diversity of biology in your soil to start turning over organic matter in a no-till system quickly. So depending on where they are on their journey or depending on where I am on my journey, we'll use compost teas. I will do some foliar micronutrients, organic micronutrients through different formulations of compost teas if we need to. I like to ferment everything, and whether it's bokashi or compost or whatever. I mean, I do think that, you know, just really driving the biology of a system first and foremost will help pull that system through. So yes, we do quite a bit of that.
And one more question about Hopewell. Did you implement anything that you thought, oh, we are really starting from scratch here? So was there something that you said, oh, we're going to do this from the get-go?
Yes. Because it had been a Christmas tree farm, there were so many opportunities to learn. I mean, it sounds like madness because there was a chemical burden. They use a lot of chemicals in the growing of Christmas trees and the sort of amount of pre-emergence that had been used. And even transitioning to organic, I was very committed to sort of this detoxification process first. And I wanted to do no-till establishment of vines, which is really, that's basically unheard of. And we did do trials there where some things went in to no-till and some things went in to a cultivated, you know, sort of system, just so that we could learn those things and then be able to share them with other people going forward. But especially establishing a no-till vineyard with a diverse understory without irrigation, that was the biggest thing. This is a limited water system where we grow wine. They're very limited water systems. It's a pretty much Mediterranean summer that we get. And so I really wanted the vines to be acclimated from very young, from establishment on, to this idea. If we want water, we got to go find it for ourselves. And so that was a process of first building enough organic matter that we could put baby vines in. And then over time, watching them kind of struggle through those first couple of years. And we even prolonged the first year of, you know, usually people will allow the plants to carry some amount of crop in their third and fourth leaf. And we pushed that out to the fourth and fifth leaf just to give them a little bit more time to establish that permanent storage.
Well, growing grapes is a learned skill, and perhaps first and foremost, it's an art, and creating wine from those grapes is as well. Have you seen the nutrient density improve over the years? I'm sure you saw improvements at Hopewell, but how does that nutrient density affect the process in creating wine, or does it? I don't know where that question came from.
it's a great question. And I think that this is what the shoreline of regenerative is really going to be looking at. And so not just in wine, but for me working, you know, with whether it's with cattle ranchers or apple growers or hardy kiwis or whatever it is, tying the nutrient density of the final product to the recovery of an ecosystem is going to be the torch that lights the way, because it is the part that we're missing. I mean, if our food system has passed its tipping point, it's because we've grown empty calories. You've covered this topic quite a bit. If we instead focused on less, but that contains more, it solves pretty much for everything. I mean, I hate speaking in panaceas, and I'm not one who likes a lot of hyperbole, but the truth is our bodies crave nutrients. Most of us are not deficient in calories at this point. And so the most exciting shift that I've seen in every system that I've worked in is that change in quality. And what you can measure with a mass spectrometer in wine in terms of phenolics and sort of the harvest chemistry that we're all looking for, so that you have a beautiful fermentation curve. Or if you're working with apples, it's so that, you know, the apples have enough anthocyanins and enough secondary plant chemistry to defend themselves and make it to the finish line with an explosive amount of flavor. That is directly tied to just what they're able to access and do in any given moment along that entire cycle of their growth, which is really a 2-year cycle if we're talking about a perennial system. And if it's beef, it's about being exposed to a lot of different, very small but very medicinal plant compounds that then translate into better fatty acid profiles, to the point where instead of having a 20-ounce steak, you get to have your meat as seasoning, because that feeds you. It truly feeds you. Right. And it's a responsible portion of meat, as opposed to just the hedonistic retraining of our palates that we've really kind of grown accustomed to in the last 75 years, where it is about calories and it's not about nutrients. We've become very sick as a result of that. And the land has become very sick as a result of that. And as the land heals, the food is healing, and that will change everything, because we will be able to do more with less land, and we will be able to put more habitat back. And as we do that, the land will heal even more, and so will our food.
So does that affect when you're actually processing and creating wine? If you have a very nutrient-dense grape, does it affect the fermentation time?
It's a great question. So if you think about it, most of what we quote unquote learn about fermentation science, about agriculture in a laboratory setting, we're controlling all of these variables. We think that yeast need sugar and nitrogen. It's a very sort of laboratory based model. But what I've observed is that when we harvest, first of all, you really do have to taste it. You come out and you taste the grapes one by one, and you taste in 7 to 10 different types of systems. And your face knows the difference instantly. Not only, you know, is it different to walk through one vineyard versus another vineyard, but our mouths, our entire olfactory system was built to know the difference between something that is going to carry us through in a medicinal way and something that is just a bag of sugar and some acid. And it is a very profound difference, and you can do it with a blindfold on. Now, in a fermentation, what you would measure, I guess, initially and base an expectation of a fermentation curve off of can be a little bit confounding, because what's locked up in nutrient density is a lot of minerals and micronutrients and keys to enzymes, basically, most of which are either unstudied or understudied or even unknown in the sort of basic yeast kinetics, which are very focused on sugar and nitrogen. But when yeast need more than just sugar and nitrogen, they need access to minerals and micronutrients along the way as well. And it's interesting that even in a nitrogen limited situation, because my nitrogens are often much lower than what you would call a commercial grape, and they'd say, oh, you're going to have to feed that fermentation with some exogenous nitrogen, which I don't do. And we still have beautiful fermentation curves that proceed what I consider to be a lovely pace for finishing without any off flavors or any loss of aroma or color or any of those things that you worry about losing along the way if your fermentation goes awry. So I do think that when it comes to true nutrition, we focus so much on macronutrients, which we have too much of. And when yeast have too much of a, you know, a McDonald's hamburger, they make a very predictable wine. And there's a lot of that out there, and I'm not interested in making it. And what I am interested in is seeing where the yeast that come in on the grapes are able to get what they need in such a way that every layer of detail that you can taste when you taste it in the field comes through transformed in the fermentation end product in the most extraordinary alchemical way, where you have a true thumbprint of not just the place, but the time and the interaction with the people. And I think that that's, to me, that is what makes wine special, and it's why it's still worth making, is that you can achieve these very, very lofty heights of transformation of a thing that would otherwise just rot in an instant. It can live as long as a person. And that's so fascinating. And it is such a unique product for that reason.
Yes. And also, speaking of unique, you've been very fortunate to be able to work with folks that you call my people, my friends, family, and the great heart that beats in all of what you do. And boy, if we only had that respect across the board for people's professions and vocations. You have been part of the Regenerative Viticulture Foundation. What are some positive effects you've seen since your involvement, and are you still involved with them?
Yes, I am. Okay. I'm one of the founding trustees.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And I think one of the most positive things that I've seen as a result of that is just this idea that you put a bat sign up into the clouds and people find you. And when people find you, you realize how many more there were than you appreciated. And what's fascinating is that, you know, sort of concurrently, so many regenerative organizations have come onto the scene, almost to the point where I have these moments, I think we should all just be working together and really combining forces. And maybe some of that will happen along the way, but they're all doing great work. And what I love about the Regenerative Viticulture Foundation is that we're really focused on making spaces, regional spaces, for people who have the same types of concerns and that are all in the farming of grapes to learn together. So putting together groups of growers to find and access relevant information for their region, for how to do, whether it's no-till in a drought-limited area or how to pick cover crops for an area that's getting a profound amount of rain in the growing season, more than they have historically, and how to basically limit spray programs where disease pressure is very high, and being able to set up grower-led trials and hold space for those things so that people can learn together. Having worked with other clients over the years, I mean, I consider them just colleagues, basically, on a journey towards regenerative. There is something that is possible when you're doing it with other people at the same time that isn't possible if you're just on a sort of singular, you know, I'm going to learn this myself. Because there are very few people, I think, that either have the luxury or the, frankly, the resolve, because you have to really suspend your disbelief, because we've become so entrenched in these systems that have gotten us this far, right? And so to really shift that paradigm is about almost a personal healing journey.
Sure.
That with support of other people who are also on the journey becomes so much less scary. And that's really what we're trying to focus on. There's this two-part driving goal, which is to aggregate a lot of regionally specific information and then connect that to groups of regional growers so that the regenerative path can be tailored to where you are and what you're facing. We don't certify anything. We're just here to spread knowledge and support and create spaces for people to support each other.
I love that. I know you're part owner at your parents' vineyard, and you've been involved with the original Hopewell, and now you have your 3 acres. Tell us about one of your wines.
Sure. The first wine I ever made was the Hopewell Pinot Noir. It's the estate Pinot Noir. It's the sort of backbone of everything that I do, and it's always some component of every cultivar of Pinot Noir that I work with. The original intent of that wine was to, every year, incorporate one more layer of the voice of the place. And through the work that we do, just the commitment, the highest standard is the standard of the land and the ecosystem and all of the ways that it calls its integrity home. I mean, it really does want to call back the things that it needs to be whole and to be stable. And so just facilitating that, that is my primary goal. The wine should be the last layer that just reads that out for other people to experience. And I remember when I came back to Bethel Heights and was working with my cousin and my family, and the idea of our estate wine, it's a magical place. I mean, it's one of those things where if you do get to visit there, you have to drive up this hill or you have to walk up this hill to, you know, kind of get to see the estate. And when you get to the top of the hill and you see it lay out before you, you can imagine the sort of singing, the singing in your ears. And the idea of the estate was really for people who will never have the benefit or the opportunity of seeing this place. If you could close your eyes and taste something that would give you that imagery and that experience, that's what you want to achieve. And that is the driving force behind the Hopewell Estate Pinot Noir. And I do think that bar can always be higher, and we can only just do our best to let that place be as much as it can be.
Yes. And so what you're telling us is the hills actually are alive with the sound of music.
It's so true. And it sounds so trite, but...
No, not at all.
I've seen it happen to so many people.
Well, it's so interesting when people start talking wine, it starts moving toward the romantic and the poetic. And it's even more beautiful when you consider the different layers of the variety and the eco-density that's going on. So is Pinot Noir your favorite?
You know, I get asked this a lot. And I think, you know, for me, I've never been good at favorites because I fall in love with everything.
Good.
And especially anything tied to the land. I also make Chenin Blanc. I've made Chardonnay. I've made Riesling. I just fall desperately in love every single time. Anything that we pick, every grape, like it's so funny. We just finished a big chunk of our harvest and I run around and I pick up the clusters that fell on the ground because I feel terrible leaving anything behind. Mm. And even the things, you know, there are plants that we don't harvest. We leave those for the birds. It's all important. And the idea that one would be more shined upon than anything else just isn't in me. So
right, nice.
Yes, I love it. And yes, it's my favorite. And yes, everything else is also my favorite.
Right. Very valid answer. I know whenever I'm getting a massage, I feel like, oh, when they're doing my feet, oh, it's my favorite part. And then,
a
minute later, they're on another part of
my
body. And
part.
I go, oh, that's my favorite part.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Mimi, what's your favorite part of your day beside wrapping up an interview?
Oh, I love meeting people like you. I think the best part of my day is actually we're very fortunate that we live tucked into sort of the foothills of the Coast Range here and are in some of the most beautiful coastal forested areas. if I can walk in the forest and just close my eyes and let the smells and the feel under my feet and all of that, it's a total reset for me. And I try to make space for that every single day, to be near trees and to be near what makes me whole. Because when I left forest research, basically, it was because I believed that to save wild nature, we had to do it through agriculture. So I try very hard to connect myself back to those pieces of truly wild nature, because what we're trying to do with the agriculture is call the wild back in. And I just want to always be in touch with that, and I want to be grounded by that, and I want to be humbled by that at least once a day.
That's great. Well, Mimi, boy, I didn't know that I would be finding such a mild-mannered radical here. I love it. Thank you so much.
Well, that's my favorite moniker so far, so thank you for that. And I just want to thank you for the work that you're doing. I really appreciate your voice and curiosity.
Many thanks to Mimi Castile from Hopewell Vineyards. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here where we all want to be. Cheers.